Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, October 28, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to have opening remarks today of about 5 to 10 minutes, maybe a little bit of back and forth, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for your questions, so please do be thinking of those. I'm going to introduce our speakers very briefly. Their bios are in the materials you received in advance of today's call. We'll hear first from Dr. Michael Ledeen. He's a Freedom Scholar at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He'll be followed by David B. Rifkin, Jr. He's a partner at Baker & Hostetler right here in Washington, D.C. And then, as I say, we might have some back and forth, but then ultimately, your questions. So with that, let's begin our program. Dr. Ledeen, the floor is yours.
Thank you. And thank you, Federalist Society, and thank you, David, for agreeing to share this time with me. The question on the floor is, what are we going to do about Iran? And my answer has long been, bring it down. And in current popular discourse, this passes for regime change in Tehran. And it's Iran has been at war with us since 1979, when the Shah was overthrown and Ayatollah Khomeini took power. He declared war against America. As we all know, Iranians chant death to America all the time in all kinds of different settings, sometimes in the streets, sometimes in parliament, sometimes in mosques, sometimes at political rallies. And they mean it. They've been killing Americans since 1979, whenever, however they can. And as even the State Department knows, Iran is the biggest international sponsor of terrorism. It's won that blue ribbon every year now for many years. I've long since lost count as to how far back that goes. And we have yet really to respond effectively against the Iranians, even in the war in Iraq. When, after a couple of years, we had established that the Iranians were training Iraqi terrorists to kill Americans, were providing them with IEDs, were manufacturing IEDs, and we even started capturing Iranians on the battlefield. We still were very reluctant to say so publicly. It took quite a while before our leaders would say that. And there was today, all over the Middle East, the Iranians are acting, and we are not responding. And I think the main reason for that during the Bush years, when we were fighting in Iraq, was that we had an excessively narrowly military view of the way to fight war in the Middle East, and that I think Bush and company thought we were going to win the war militarily in Iraq and then move on to Iran, still militarily, when really our most powerful weapon against Iran is political, not military. There's no reason to invade Iran, let alone bomb Iran, which we talk about all the time. And the reason for that is if you look at the behavior of the Iranian regime, you will see that they are terrified of their own people. And yes, from time to time, this contempt that the people have for the regime surfaces. We saw it in 2009 when millions of people took to the streets after the phony elections of June of that year. And you see it, if you follow Iran closely, almost all the time. There's always strikes, demonstrations going on. Right now, there's a nationwide teachers' protest going on. There are student protests. The Green Movement is still very much alive, and it stages demonstrations. The Ahwazi Arabs down in the south, which is the oil-producing region down around Basra, they protest all the time against the regime. And consequently, the tempo of arrest, torture, and killing has increased under the so-called moderate president, Rouhani. And they're headed for, right now, over the course of the last 2 years, Iran leads the world in per capita executions. And they should reach 1,000 for this year relatively soon. So the fact that they're doing all this killing and that they've increased all this repression shows, I think, just how worried they are, because they know that people don't like them. The country, after all, is a basket case. The food is in short supply. Subsidies that the government for a long time gave the people have been cut back. The bazaar is suffering and so forth. And what they're counting on, what they're so enthusiastic and hopeful about, is getting these 100 plus billions of dollars as a result of the end of sanctions, as the byproduct of the big deal, so-called nuclear deal, that they've never signed and haven't agreed to and keep trying to change every day and modify and so forth. They hope this will give them the money to pay off the people and reduce tensions, and also, of course, finance their various nefarious activities, whether it's long-range missiles or building nuclear weapons or financing Hamas or Hezbollah or the Quds Force, which is fighting in Syria, and so forth. So I think that this is a situation tailor-made for traditional American revolutionary diplomacy. And I've been saying to people for years, if we could bring down the Soviet Union by supporting Soviet dissidents, and the Soviet Empire was a big deal, Iran is much less of a deal, and the level of popular opposition to the regime in Iran is light years greater than it was in the Soviet Empire during the Gorbachev years. And it's just made for us. If the President of the United States would stand up and say, okay, enough already. We will not any longer tolerate Americans being killed by the Iranians. And we're going to support the Iranian people who have just complaints about this regime, and we're going to support them in their rightful indignation. I think it would have a fantastic effect. And then carry on, as just as we did at the end of the Cold War, by supporting dissident elements inside the country. We're talking about communications gear. We're talking about probably some funding. We're not talking about weapons or bombs or air forces or invasions or anything of the sort. And the regime dreads this. They expect that it would succeed. I think they are terribly surprised that they're still in power, because I think in 2009 they expected that we would support the people in the streets and that they would fall, and they would then have to go into exile as the Shah did. I have one last point to make, and it's about President Obama, and then I'll turn it over to David. Obama, for a very long time, has been passionately looking for a strategic alliance with Iran. This started even before he became president. During the presidential campaign of 2008, he sent a personal representative, retired Ambassador William Miller, to Tehran to talk to the Iranian leaders, to tell them that when Obama became president, he was always very confident of that, that when he became president, relations between our two countries would dramatically improve, and we would now be able to work together and be together and jointly do wonderful things together all over the Middle East. I don't understand that. I've never heard a convincing explanation for him. I find it no trouble to understand how a left-wing American president would want to normalize relations with Cuba or even improve relations with Russia. What I don't get, what I don't understand, and I'm convinced that there's something in his life story that we're missing here, that I'm missing anyway, which is why on earth would you be passionate about embracing this dreadful country, one of the most oppressive on earth, a country that kills Americans all the time, that represses women, that represses religious minorities, that executes gays, lesbians, homosexuals, all that. And so what are we missing there? Why does he do that? What is driving it? The fact of the matter remains that he's very passionate about it. And unfortunately, I don't see any hope that he will adopt my policy, although I certainly hope everybody else does. So, David, here's to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. I would actually answer your question first, since it's somewhat different. The answer, I think, has nothing to do with Iran as such, and then tackle the broader issue about what our policies should be towards the Mullah regime in Tehran. As to Obama, I mean, I'm speculating, but I would say this. I think that one of the themes that runs through his foreign policy is a feeling of serious disdain for previous foreign policy strategies and arrangements, and not just under George W. Bush, but a number of his predecessors. So let's say the fundamental rejection of the legitimacy of America's role as the leading guardian of international order and stability, and as part and parcel of that rejection, frankly, of the legitimacy of utility of numerous alliance relationships that we've had. And in that context, I think his natural inclination is to be hard on our friends and be quite willing to be extremely generous and extremely forgiving towards our enemies. And that, of course, explains fairly well his policies towards Russia, towards China, towards Tehran. Now, I think the answer here is, by the way, not that he has some special affinity for the Shiite version of Islam as distinct from the Sunnis. It just so happens that the leading Sunni Arab states have been the traditional allies, not great allies to be sure, but traditional allies of the United States for decades, going back to the establishment of a House of Saud. Ditto with Jordan, ditto with Egypt. Certainly since the downfall of Bashar, which takes us back to the Jimmy Carter years, Iran has been a sworn enemy of the United States. So I think that that's what's in play here. And by the way, let me also try to defend him a little bit. I'm certainly a critic of his administration, president's foreign policy. I don't think he necessarily feels that countries like Iran or Russia or China are pursuing good policies, Michael. I think he understands the problems with their domestic policies that are extremely, shall we say anything else aside, not only undemocratic, but extremely unprogressive. You mentioned the brutality towards homosexuals and women, or the fact that their foreign policies are quite destructive. I think, however, as an institutional matter, if you believe that American influence and the kind of Pax Americana that we sought to build is a bad thing, you kind of feel that this is a time to change the players, time to open up the international system to the new powers. They're not perfect. They're making mistakes, but it's their time. Anyway, don't have proof of that, but that would be my explanation. Now, as to your suggestion, let me say we agree in many respects, but disagree in one important respect. We agree that it would be wonderful if there was a regime change in Iran. I think that Iran is an extremely dangerous power that's frankly punching well above its weight, both in terms of its efforts to dominate the region, in terms of its support for terrorism, in terms of its efforts to become a nuclear power. These are all very dangerous strategies, and I don't think that we can ever have a viable coexistence or deterrent strategy. I frankly think that, and I'm sure you agree, that Iran is beyond deterrence in ways which the Soviet Union was not. Number one. Number two, I certainly don't mind. Indeed, I strongly support efforts to destabilize the Iranian regime, and I am just as sad as you are that the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, envisions releasing all of the frozen funds and lifting of virtually all of the sanctions. In fact, as we know, for the last year and a half, while frozen funds have not been released, the sanctions have been effectively lifted and that they've been under enforced. So certainly going back to the time when the interim agreement was being negotiated, the sanctions have lost their bite, improperly so, both as a matter of foreign policy and as a matter of law. But that's what we're facing. So I certainly don't mind providing the kind of help to the Iranian dissidents that we provided to the dissidents in the Soviet Union. I may take a little bit of an issue with you as to what it entailed. I'm not a student of Iran or Persia. I, before my days as a lawyer, I was a student of the Soviet Union and quite familiar a long time ago what exactly we've done. As far as the Soviet Union itself is concerned, aside from championing the cause of democracy and human rights, we've really not provided any funding to the dissidents in the Soviet Union or any communication gear. What you may be thinking of is during the Reagan administration, we got behind efforts to provide funding to various dissident groups in the Central and Eastern Europe, particularly in Poland, where the John Paul II, the Catholic Church, and a number and labor unions were beginning to push hard against the established communist regime. It was a viable strategy in part because there are considerable restraint exhibited by the Polish communist government for a variety of reasons that probably no time to get into it now. So we were much more overt, if you will, in our support for the dissident forces in Poland, the Czech Republic, and several other places in Eastern and Central Europe, aside from rhetorical and diplomatic support, not so much with regard to the Soviet Union. Now, my final point would be this. Again, I defer to you on what is the balance of power these days between the dissidents in Iran and the government. But my sense, and I could well be wrong, that while there is enormous unhappiness with the regime, and it is indeed possible that if we pushed hard in support of a green movement in 2009, things would be different today. My sense is that, at least now, there is not a very strong effort to bring about a regime change. You have some of the classical fissures, divisions within the Iranian body politic that you see in many other countries where you have sort of urban intelligentsia that is much more westernized and interested in living better and having more freedoms and has profound disdain for the mullahs. The same is true with regard to the Bazari, which are basically merchant class, not so much with regard to a lot of folks in the rural area. And that's, where you get majority of recruits for the so-called Basiji. Again, you know more about this stuff than I do, but this is sort of the junior cousins of the Revolutionary Guards that are providing the manpower for regime to beat up dissidents and enforce all sorts of repressive laws and ordinances. But I also wonder, given the existence of Iranian nationalism, whether or not sort of an overt embrace of dissidents, public indications, and maybe that's not what you had in mind, that we're trying to provide them with communications equipment and financial support would necessarily be welcomed by this group, so would it be used by the regime to try to delegitimize them as being sort of pro-American stooges? I could be wrong, but I guess what I would say is we should have a very hard policy, tough policy towards Iran. Not going to happen under this administration, but hopefully in January of the inauguration of a new president, in January of 2017, we would reestablish the sanctions. We would we would provide strong support to the Sunni Arab governments and pretty much everybody who is fighting against the Iranian influence in the region. We would change our policy vis-a-vis Israel. We'll do a lot of things like that. We can provide covertly support to the dissidents, but I would be reluctant even at that time to make regime change as a basic tenet of our policy. Well, let me stop here.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. This is Dean again. I want to open the floor to questions. First, I want to give Dr. Ladin a chance to respond. But let me open questions before I give you a chance to respond, Dr. Ladin, if you could bear with me just a second. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button. Dr. Ladin, while we're waiting to see if anybody wants to ring in, do you want to respond to or revise or extend your remarks at all?
I want to thank David for his thoughtful comments. The central question is always how explosive is a given society? We're very bad both as policymakers and as social scientists at predicting revolutions, uprisings. People were amazed when millions of people took to the streets. People over here in Washington, intelligence community, et cetera, were astonished to see millions of people in the streets in 2009. There were more people in the streets in 2009 than there were in 79 at the time of the overthrow of the Shah. Where did they all come from? Whereas previously they'd all been arguing there is no organized opposition and there are no leaders of that organized opposition and so forth, and they were shown to be wrong. I trust the behavior of the regime. Yes, I have contacts in among some of those opposition groups and leaders. After all, the people the Iranians I negotiated with in the mid-1980s, were the people around Mousavi, and Mousavi turned out 30 years later to be the leader of the Green Movement, and I have been in touch with those people ever since. They've been good sources of information and understanding of Iran. Well, the fact that if you look at the regime, the regime is just wild at clamping down on any sign of dissent, whether it's a poet or a rock musician or a fashion model or a politician. They go right after them in the most vicious way imaginable. And I think they know much more about this than we do. And so the fact that they're so active and that the repression is increasing shows, I think, that the dynamics inside the country are very explosive. The regime knows, and that's why they behave the way they do.
Once again, if you have a question, our lines are wide open at this point. We don't have a question pending. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Maybe I can get things started here. Both David Rifkin, you mentioned, I'm paraphrasing here, that the teeth have sort of gone out of the sanctions. Dr. Ladin, back in July of this year, late July of this year, you wrote at your astonishment about members of Congress when you speak to them that they do not know that we have been sending the Iranian regime upwards of $700 million a month. We've been doing it for a year and a half, and I'm paraphrasing again there. How is it that and I take it that means that we've been unfreezing assets at that rate and releasing them to the Iranian regime. Is that what you're saying there? And David, is that what you mean by the sanctions really haven't been effective? And as part two of this question for Dr. Ladin, you said that the Iran is essentially a basket case, and they're hoping that with the ease of sanctions, as those are lifted, the country can right itself, and I guess they'll have some return to stability. Are they right in that? Has the $700 million a month made a difference? Will the release of sanctions going forward make a bigger difference? So those are my questions at this point.
Well, let me go first, if Michael doesn't mind, because the point is dear and near to my heart. I mean, aside from the unique problems with the under-enforcement of Iranian sanctions. There is a broader pattern here, and the broader pattern is that this administration has been more aggressive in going beyond the meets and bounds of its constitutional authority. It has systematically under-enforced, and just under-enforced my foot, just refused to enforce law statutes signed by Congress. It has refused to comply with clear constitutional requirements that, for example, that's the basis of a House lawsuit against this administration. They've withdrawn money from Treasury, not in consequence of appropriations. There's a lawsuit now pending brought by a number of states with Texas in the lead that indicates that they raised taxes without congressional approval. Of course, both power to raise taxes and power to withdraw money from Treasury entirely within Article One. We have, President refusing to defend in court statutes. So we have, in a sense, imperial presidency greater than anything in our history, and not with regard to pure foreign policy actions where the Article II is its greatest strength, but with regard to domestic policy. Now, that's been aided and abetted by the fact that historically, I have to say, Congress also bears some responsibility with the state of affairs. First, because during this administration, it is not in any meaningful fashion called the president to account. We have partisanship that supplanted an overwhelmed institutional loyalty. That's why, senior Democrat congressional leaders are basically applauding every time the president usurps congressional authority. And to be fair, not just now, but for years and years, Congress has written statutes, including various sanctions legislation, both specific to Iran, but also more generic, things like Trading with the Enemies Act, that is enormously capacious and gives the president an opportunity to enforce it almost without sort of a meaningful limiting principle. And a combination of all those factors has produced the situation where sanctions have been unenforced for a long time. Yes, some of the frozen funds have been released. So what's coming as a result of JCPOA is basically the completion, a culmination of this trend, but not an entirely new phenomenon.
Dr.
Right.
Ledeen?
It's Michael Ledeen. I think that the regular payments, which have been sometimes in cash, and sometimes in kind, a bunch of gold that had been blocked by South African banks as part of sanctions went back to Iran not so long ago, and that's part of the payoff. We've been paying off Iran since the interim agreement was signed. What's that now? 2+ years ago. And yes, it's helped them. It's helped them defray expenses. But they're still, thanks to banking sanctions. And notice how eager they are to get out from under the exclusion from the SWIFT network, because they can't pay bills internationally. They can't write checks. They can't do wire transfers. They're in a tough situation. When you asked earlier about Iran being a basket case, if you look at the numbers that they themselves come out with, and you have to assume that they try to understate the failure of the regime, they talk about epidemic levels of depression, suicide, drug addiction, prostitution. That is all the social indicators that show the failure of a state. They've got them all. So, and yes, I'm flabbergasted still to this day when we were debating, when Congress was debating the no deal deal, as I call it, which Iran, by the way, is still not signed, and which the Supreme Leader continues to say, well, we don't know if we're going to agree to this. All depends on how they behave, as if it's all our fault. I'm still flabbergasted at how little staff members on Congress, even members of Congress, members of key committees, know about what we actually have been doing with Iran for the last several years. In essence, I think it's hard to argue against the claim that our foreign policy in the Middle East comes out of Tehran. I mean, look at the fact that we've just invited the Iranians to this the Russian-Syrian meeting to discuss the future of the Assad regime and how to deal with ISIS in the Middle East. Inviting Iran to that is crazy because Iran simply piggybacks onto Russia as one of the two great supporters of Assad, which is to say we have asked a country to come in there which is diametrically opposed and which we know is diametrically opposed to what we say we want to accomplish in the Middle East right now. And we're doing it, I'm convinced, because Obama wants a strategic alliance with Iran and he doesn't want to do anything that will upset Iran and he wants to do everything he possibly can to make them happy and make them as important and powerful and influential and consequential as he possibly can. What David said about why Obama embraces Iran is certainly true. That is, he rejects past American policies. He thinks we are the cause of many of the world's problems, particularly in the Middle East. And one of the great errors he thinks we made in the past was to support the Shah. Okay, I get all that. But that doesn't get you to a passionate desire to embrace the Supreme Leader Khamenei and to support a country as horrible as Iran. That still leaves me rather breathless and still leaves me kind of baffled. And I am convinced that if I live long enough, that we'll get an answer to that. And that answer will be part of his biography that we're not aware of.
We've got quite a few people on the line. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button. We'd welcome you to the conversation. I'm not sure I heard, and I asked a multi-level question, I guess, but the sanctioned money that has been released already, the sanctions, that the assets that stand to be released going forward, is that enough to make Iran a little more stable? Is that enough to... Will their hopes be realized that the basket case will be righted, more or less?
I'll give a very fast two-part answer. Number one, it's a lot of money. $100, $150 billion is a huge amount of money for a country with a population of 75 million. Will it make things better? Probably not a whole lot better, because I think they'll mostly spend that money on expanding military power, terrorism, and so forth, and not on the well-being of the Iranian people. And secondly, the Iranian regime has an enormous capacity to mess things up. And no matter how much money they have, they'll continue to wreck the society. It's what they do.
I agree with this is David Rifkin. I agree with both of these points. I would say, though, that estimates differ. It's $150 billion, whether it's $90 billion, $120 billion, and I've seen a range of numbers. It is an exceedingly bad decision. Some of those monies are going to end up, despite the fact that bulk of it would go towards paying for Iran's regional and global ambitions. Some of their money is going to end up in the Iranian economy. I agree with Michael. There's tremendous corruption. In fact, as we know, there is really a state within a state with the Revolutionary Guards controlling directly and indirectly most of the leading Iranian companies. But, I would say a few billion dollars would end up being used perhaps to provide some additional subsidies to the particularly to the urban centers, so that would happen. I would say I'm hopeful as a lawyer that there would be folks litigating this matter. There, for those who are listening, viable legal arguments to challenge the president's ability to release the block funds, and either block it entirely or at the very least tie it up for a protracted period of time. So I hope it takes place. It is a bad thing and would certainly inure to our tremendous disadvantage. And let's not forget the release of lifting of the sanctions, because we're talking about a double whammy here. Both the frozen funds flowing back to Iran, as well as Iran's ability to participate fully in the international economic system, ability to sell its oil, which, again, I've seen different estimates, but we're talking about $40, $50, $60 billion plus per year of revenue investment by, and let's be clear, we're talking about investment by European and Asian companies. I doubt very much that any American company, at least the U.S. parent, would be going and investing even in the most benign project in Iran, be it a hotel or, you know, subway or something like that. So all of those things are very unfortunate. I wish they were not coming to pass. I hope they can be stopped litigation-wise, but it remains to be seen.
Once again, if you have a question for our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have one question at this point. Before we go to the audience, let me just make a quick announcement. The convention, the Federal Society of National Lawyers Convention, scheduled for November 12th through 14th. The annual dinner on the 12th is near sold out, so if you plan to go to the convention, you should probably attend to that sooner rather than later. In terms of upcoming Teleforum calls, we've got two calls, one on Thursday, one on Friday, scheduled each at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Check our website for details. Let's now take our first call of the day.
Regarding a comparison to the breakup of the Soviet Union and the expression of dissidents, isn't it very difficult to say who in Iran, how many, and what their capacity would be, would rise up? Certainly, we saw a great demonstration in the past, but considering that during the time of the challenge to the Soviet Union, now released prisoners are telling the West that they used to run out and demonstrate and just hope that there might be a U.S. camera or Western press agent there who would catch their action on camera, knowing that then there would be that response on the part of the West. And we also look at the fact that we had Maggie Thatcher, the Pope, Ronald Reagan, all working together to support this kind of expression. And then looking at specifically Poland, there was a tremendous religious movement through Father Jerzy Popiełuszko and some others, so that there was kind of a perfect storm, but the dissidents knew that there would be tremendous support from the West. And certainly we are not telegraphing such now, not just the United States, but NATO and other countries as well. So that's just something I think is very, very hard to know what the numbers might be. But I do have a specific question for David. What do you see the standing of states who have sanctions regimes against Iran in place? I guess there are 25 states now. What do you think the role might be if states have the level of standing to, when it comes to a contest with the federal government on this? What is the state role as far as existing sanctions and maybe prosecuting new sanctions?
Thank you. Well, let me say a couple of things briefly. I agree that the dissolution of the Soviet Union indeed came as a result of a perfect storm. I would just add Lech Walesa and Solidarność to the mix, alongside the church and numerous other forces. I think it was very, very unique, very powerful. I don't see anything capable of replicating, and the other players you mentioned, of course, Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, nothing. It's easy for us to replicate. I will defer to Michael as to, again, the strength of the Iranian dissents and, you know, who are the Andrei Sakharovs and the Solzhenitsyns and Lech Walesas of Persia today. As for the litigation sanctions, I think states can play a role. I think states can have stronger sections of their own. It's a complicated legal question. I don't want to get into the details here, but states can bolster the existing sanctions. States can never have sanctions that are as robust as those of the federal government for constitutional reasons. There are some things the states just cannot do because of a dormant commerce clause and a couple of other restrictions, but they can do more. States can litigate to challenge the president's, or not so much president's, but executive branch officials like Secretary of Treasury, who is lifting sanctions because the question of what is the correct existing federal statutory baseline, if you will, vis-a-vis Iran, sanctions-wise, is a key question in determining how far the states can proceed with their own sanctions. So if the relevant baseline of sanctions is suspended by the president, the states have less authority. If a relevant baseline of the sanctions is not properly suspended by the president, but remaining in full force, the states can do more. There are good arguments, primarily based upon what happened with Corker-Cardin and the president's failure to comply with Corker-Cardin by submitting the full bevy of all the agreements, in particular the side deal with IAEA. That means that the president's ability to lift sanctions such as it was under the previous sanction statutes, is frozen. So states can do that, but I also think that the best parties to challenge both the lifting of the sanctions and the releasing of frozen funds are dozens and dozens of individuals who have obtained money judgments against Iran because of its support of specific terrorist actions. There are billions of dollars of such judgments who have never been satisfied. I think that holders of such judgments would be in a best position standing-wise to mount those challenges.
David, it's Michael. Some member of Congress introduced a bill requiring that all those people who had received judgments against Iran should be paid before any sanctions relief could be given to Iran. And I know that was introduced. I don't know where it stands. So there are even members of Congress who are thinking along the same lines you are.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say that legislation will not pass. And while they're well-meaning, Michael, we have to distinguish, at least as a legal matter, between congressional effort to provide new rights for the holders of money judgment against Iran, which was legislation tried to do, and again, it would not pass, versus what rights do they have now without any new legislation. What I was talking about is litigation to vindicate the rights they have now.
Right. Okay.
Well, we still have time left. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see who rings in yet.
Well, can I respond to the broad question of comparing it to Soviet times, and was that a perfect storm back when Gorbachev fell and so forth? Revolutions are always, I'm an historian, and I can tell you that revolutions always appear in retrospect to have been a perfect storm. They're rare, and most of the time they fail. And when they succeed, we're not altogether always sure why they succeeded. However, think along these lines. At the time that we supported the opposition to communism in the Soviet Empire, and it's not just the Soviet Union, it's the Soviet Empire, it's Poland, it's Czechoslovakia, It's even East Germany, where there was, of all things, a big peace movement going that we were able to support and which had certain effects. Maybe 5 to 10% of the population of the Soviet Empire was willing to take chances to challenge the regime under those circumstances. Today in Iran, my goodness, the regime itself takes polls where upwards of 70% of the population say they'd like to see regime change in Iran, that they're unhappy with what's going on, that they'd like the chance to have a referendum on do they want to continue with an Islamic Republic or do they want something different and all of that. We should be openly, explicitly, not covertly, openly supporting these people and these efforts. And one of the things that was done, particularly by Scholz, during the Cold War, was every time there was an international meeting, he would go with a list of political prisoners, and he would read them out publicly, and he would say to the Soviet representatives, Gromyko and so forth, these people are unjustly arrested. Let them out. Let them go free. Give them freedom of speech and all of that. We should be doing those things. Those are things that should be done openly, not covertly. If there are things that need to be done covertly, I'm not sure, but they will tell us. So, number one, we have to support the opposition publicly. Number two is we have to go and start talking to them, which we are not doing.
We'd welcome further questions. Push the star button and the pound button. Let me ask a follow-up if I could. In terms of revolutionary diplomacy, revolutions are hard to make sure they're going to succeed. And we've talked about the number of dissidents. Are you fairly confident that if we practiced revolutionary diplomacy and were successful at that, that we wouldn't be left with another despotic government on the heels of this one? That is, that the right dissidents would rise to the surface to govern the country?
My grandmother, who was the smartest member of the family that I've known, always used to say, she was Russian, so this explains it in part. She always used to say, things are never so bad they can't get worse.
Right.
So, yes, above all, do no harm. Be careful. So far as I can tell, the leaders of most of the opposition groups are tired of radical Islam, are tired of theological dictatorship, and want to be part of the Western world. They're not Arabs. They don't think of themselves as Arabs. They think of themselves as different. And traditionally, their major allies have been, with the exception of Russia, which has meddled in Iranian affairs for a long time, with the exception of Russia, their major allies have been in the West, Great Britain, the United States, Germany, very important, and so forth. So I'm pretty optimistic that things would get dramatically better. I think that the Iranian people at this point would opt for a kind of vanilla version of secular parliamentary republic. And I think the people they would elect would tend to be people without turbans and who didn't object to anybody jumping through a fire on New Year's Day.
Well, let me make a final call for questions. Then I'm going to ask each of you, if we get no questions, to sum up and see if you have a final thought. If you have a question, this is the time. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Still got lots of folks on the call, but none with a question. So with that, why don't we go in reverse order? I'll go to David Rifkin first and then to Michael Ledeen. David Rifkin, a final thought here?
Well, my final thought is that I think both Michael and I agree that the Iranian regime is extremely dangerous, both for the region as well as globally, extremely dangerous for U.S. interests, that any kind of accommodation or long-term cooperation along the lines that this administration has envisioned is foolhardy, would not work, that pushing hard against Iran with a goal of neutralizing and defeating their regional policies, their effort to get nuclear weapons, their efforts to sponsor terrorism is utmost priority for the United States and hopefully would be pursued robustly by the next administration. And measures to undermine the Iranian regime would also be a good thing, and regime change there is very, very much in our interest.
Final thought from Michael Adine.
Yeah, we are the only truly revolutionary country in the world, and I think it's with regard to Iran specifically, and here I'm endorsing everything David has just said about how dangerous Iran is and how rotten Iran is and how evil Iran is. I think we should bring our revolutionary tradition to bear on Iran. The Iranian people are waiting for it. When they were in the streets, they were carrying signs saying, "Are you with us or against us? Where are you, Obama?" And the answer is Obama's been on the side of the oppression, of the theological dictatorship, and that's got to change. If it doesn't change, they're going to win, and eventually they're going to come after us. And what they will do to us, you can see today inside Iran, because what they're doing to the Iranians is what they will do to us if they win. And we better get at it.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time today. Michael Adine, David Rifkin, we certainly appreciate you being on our Teleform conference call today. To the audience, thank you as well for joining our call. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleform is tomorrow at 2 p.m., but until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.